I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. For 60 years, the American Psychiatric Association has published and updated its compendium of mental disorders known as the DSM. One of the more well-known revisions was homosexuality, which was called a disease until it was removed from the manual in 1973. The new DSM was published earlier this year, and Asperger's syndrome is no longer a standalone disorder, while hoarding has been added. The authors use new brain studies and biological factors, along with physical and behavioral symptoms, to describe and diagnose psychological conditions. The DSM-5 has its critics, including the director of the National Institute of Mental Health and our guest, Gary Greenberg. He's the author of The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. He says, as the mind is not like the body, and not every difficulty is a disorder. Gary Greenberg is an author, a practicing psychotherapist, a contributing writer for Mother Jones, and a contributing editor for Harper's, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Gary Greenberg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here.
So how do you use the DSM? You're a practicing psychotherapist.
I use it gingerly.
Meaning?
Meaning that when a client wants to use their insurance to help them pay for therapy, I render a diagnosis, and the diagnosis comes out of the DSM. Usually I do that collaboratively. I let them know what the diagnoses are and what they mean and what effects they could have on their long-term picture, because it goes into your medical dossier. And I try to do everything I can to make it clear that this doesn't really have much to do with treatment.
Well, and it's oftentimes referred to as a Bible, and I have to say that the practicing psychologists that I know use it, but I don't think they think of it as a Bible.
Yeah, in reality, nobody thinks of it as a Bible. Even the most, I mean, if what we mean by Bible is sort of a reliable scripture, even the most ardent defenders of the DSM think that, no, that it's at its best a collection of useful constructs. That really has a place as a common language for people to be able to talk about things, and that's about it. So the idea of it as a Bible is really just an add-on that nobody's fully comfortable with.
But do you like the idea of having a common language, that there are certain diagnoses and language used for diagnoses, so that psychologists or practicing psychotherapists can talk to their patients, or psychiatrists can talk to each other?
I think English actually suffices as a common language. And I think that there are advantages to it, but if you did a careful cost-benefit analysis, I think you'd find that the disadvantages outweigh the advantages of this particularly deracinated and desiccated and superficial language.
Well, one of your critiques, and you have many of the DSM, is that it has, medicalized many conditions that are just kind of part of life.
Yeah, what it's done is it's medicalized mental suffering in general, and divided up the kingdom of suffering into many little duchies, none of which has a basis in reality. So it has given people the false impression that we therapists and psychiatrists and psychologists and so on know what disorders they have, what diseases they have, in the same way that we know if they have strep throat or cancer. And that's just not true.
Because you're saying you can't use the disease model, the medical model, when talking about mental conditions?
Yeah, that's right. You can't, and when I say you can't, it's not necessarily because of any prejudice I have about these things. It's because we don't have the kind of knowledge about mental suffering that we do about some physical suffering. We don't have the knowledge about lots of physical suffering either. We sort of pretend that we do. But yes, I mean that we don't, for instance, Tom Insel, the man you mentioned before, the head of the NIMH, says, look, the problem with the DSM is that it encourages people to think that there's such a thing, for instance, as schizophrenia, when there really isn't. I mean, people have delusions and hallucinations and are terribly mentally disturbed. But the idea that there's a disease out there that we could call schizophrenia in the same way that we could call a disease diabetes or cancer, it's just not true. There are many ways to get to the symptoms of any particular disorder.
One of the things that the DSM has done and others have done, which is to look at some of this new brain research, some of the new genetic research, and try to use this to help us understand people's mental conditions. You challenge that as well.
Well, yeah, on two grounds. First of all, we know very little. And to the extent that we do know, those biological findings don't support the DSM. They don't map. You know, it's as if you're looking at trying to get around Philadelphia with a map of the moon. And the other problem is that it assumes that that's actually what's going to happen, that we're going to, when we look into the brain, when we finally understand the entire brain, we're going to find the mental disorders there. That assumes that the brain is both the necessary and the sufficient condition for consciousness as well as for suffering, and we don't know that. We may never be able to prove that.
But haven't we learned over the years that there are some, for instance, some genetic components when it comes to certain mental conditions?
Yes, but they contradict the DSM.
So,
for instance, there are familial studies that show that it's very likely that some schizophrenia and some bipolar disorder come from a common genetic problem. So that and there are other similar findings that indicate that the boundaries that we've established between among these disorders don't exist, at least not to the extent that they are replicated or supported by nature. So, no, the more we know, the less we're certain we are, at least so far. We're in the earliest days mm-hmm. of understanding the brain. This is, you know, 100 years from now going to look like the Dark Ages.
But are you saying that that research on the brain is not going to tell us what we want to know, or we're just so early in this brain research that we cannot use what we know to come up with a diagnosis
well,
for
that's,
somebody?
Well, that's certainly true. The second thing you said is true. Whether it's going to tell us what we want to know, I'm not sure, but what I think generally happens with these things is that research into the brain will change the way we understand our suffering. And consequently, the findings will support the new model. So we'll come to think of our suffering as primarily chemically determined. It's already happened. Look at all the people who think they have depression because they have a chemical imbalance. And yet, scientifically speaking, we haven't found any chemical imbalance that underlies depression. It's a myth. This kind of knowledge is mythological knowledge, and it generally doesn't withstand the scrutiny of science.
This is a more practical question, but the DSM is used in many ways for insurance reimbursement. I mean, that's you fill out the form so that you or your patient can get reimbursed by an insurance company. How does that trouble you?
Well, it troubles me in lots of ways, not the least of which is that you've got a treatment, psychotherapy, which is supposed to be all about honesty, and yet at the basis of it, you start with a lie. Because when you say to somebody who comes in, look, you want to use your insurance, but I have to diagnose you with a mental illness, most people will say, well, wait a minute, I'm not mentally ill. Mm-hmm. And in fact, although nobody's ever successfully defined mental illness, it's not too much to say that they're not. This is just a ruse. That we go through. It's a performance, a pantomime that we go through in order to collect money, and that troubles me.
But rather than saying mental illness, what about saying, you know, a mental condition, for instance? I mean, does that soften?
Yes, but that's a euphemism. I mean, the point about insurance is that the reason the insurance companies are paying for it is because theoretically it's a medical practice treating a medical problem. I don't have any problem with it if it was upfront and honest, but then we wouldn't need the diagnosis. We would just say, this person's unhappy, this person is anxious, whatever it is, and consequently the insurance company, but that's not how we give out money in the society. You need to have a disease. So the tail wags the dog.
Well, in fact, I'm trying to imagine an insurance company, because I know a lot of doctors have to fight with insurance companies in order to get paid. If you said, well, my patient is unhappy and I need to see him three times a week, you're not going to get much response from the insurance company.
No, and actually, if you just say, look, I have a drug that I'd like to develop and the drug is going to treat people's unhappiness, you're not going to have much success getting your drug through the FDA. Or if you say, I'd like to research unhappiness, you're not going to have much success getting money for that research. The disease labels provided by the DSM are extremely valuable, but by everybody's account, the labels don't refer to a reality. So it's an Alice in Wonderland world that the DSM creates, where the whole apparatus is founded on this myth.
But what about more serious conditions? You mentioned, you know, manic depression or even depression itself. And people do suffer with this. And I certainly know people that have gotten treatment for that, including medication, and they do feel better.
Yes. Well, nobody's denying that therapy and medications and all sorts of other interventions work because they make people feel better. But that's not the same thing as saying that they cure or treat a particular disease. If I give you aspirin and it makes your headache go away, I haven't treated a disease.
Right.
And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. It's the idea that you have to be treating the disease and that therefore you tell somebody, okay, the reason you're unhappy is because you have clinical depression, or the reason that you're behaving this way is because you're bipolar. When you tell people that, it changes the way they think about themselves. It changes the way they understand their lives. And that's the crucial difference. This is not to gainsay that they feel better.
But, I mean, if you were to tell someone you have cancer, I mean, it tells them something about themselves. You're saying that there is no such thing as manic depression or that we can't define it?
There's not a disease of bipolar disorder in the same way that there's a disease of cancer, or there are many diseases. And the reason for that is because we expect our diseases to be to have a basis in biology, and there's simply no biological findings. All we have at our disposal are symptoms, and there's nothing wrong with creating a language where we can describe symptoms. To then collect them under a label and make that label a quasi-medical label is to take an additional step which simply isn't supported by the scientific evidence. And in saying that, I'm not arguing anything that the psychiatrists who write the DSM would disagree with. They hope someday that those diseases will have biological findings to them, but at the moment they don't. And as I was saying earlier, the more we know, the less it looks like DSM is an accurate description of what we would find as we explore this farther.
About a minute before our first break here, but are you saying then that all this interest and research in brain and biology has kind of muddied the waters when it comes to a diagnosis and has over-medicalized a diagnosis?
Well, I actually don't think that's the case. I think that the research is undermining the diagnostic regime. I think that's why there's a tension between the National Institute of Mental Health and the American Psychiatric Association, which produces the DSM. There's a tension there because what NIMH is doing is undermining, not intentionally, but it's undermining the epistemology of the DSM. And the reason is because the waters are being muddied by these findings. And increasingly, the focus is not on the disorders, it's on the symptoms, which makes a lot of sense because that's what we can really know.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Gary Greenberg is our guest today on Radio Times. He's a practicing psychotherapist, a contributing writer to Mother Jones, a contributing editor for Harper's, and author of a new book we are talking about called The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. And DSM stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, something that the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, has published and updated for some 60 years now. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
1 in 3 families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, aged 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at IamConcerned.org.
On the next Fresh Air...
14 months ago, you went on the air and called the Tea Party the American Taliban.
I did.
And?
The Taliban resented it.
That's Jeff Daniels as cable news anchor Will McAvoy and Marcia Gay Harden as the network's First Amendment lawyer in Aaron Sorkin's HBO drama The Newsroom. Season 2 begins Sunday. On the next Fresh Air, we feature our interview with Jeff Daniels. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Nearly 29,000 prisoners on hunger strike in California, a protest against solitary confinement.
They do everything alone. They have no meaningful human contact.
From the cell block to the Supreme Court, the ongoing fight over prison conditions in California. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, first published in 1952. It's been updated in the 60 years since, including this year with its fifth edition. It has been hailed by some, and I have to say has its critics, including our guest Gary Greenberg. He has a book called The Book of Woe, the DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. We'd love to hear from some of the psychologists, psychiatrists, psychotherapists in our audience. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Gary, your book in part is a history of the DSM, and you go back to Vienna, to Dr. Freud, and some of the quotes here seem to indicate his worry of the sort of medicalizing of the profession that he helped to found.
Yeah, the DSM can be thought of as the bastard offspring of an estranged bedfellowship. Between a marriage of convenience, really, between medicine and psychoanalysis. And it was not a voluntary marriage. The New York Psychoanalytic Institute basically declared that psychoanalysis could only be practiced by MDs. This wasn't about insurance payments in 1926, but it was about sort of owning, appropriating psychoanalysis. And as a result, over the years it evolved that therapy, psychotherapy, increasingly was a medical practice. And then when the economics caught up with it, to be a medical practice, it had to prove itself. And this has been psychiatry's burden, actually for its entire existence, is to prove itself to be a genuine medical practice, just as legitimate as any other.
But do you then see psychiatry as different from psychology and psychologists?
Well, I'm not sure I know what you mean by different.
If you're a psychologist and let's say you're a PhD psychologist, mm-hmm. You're a PhD mm-hmm. person. Do you see that PhD as different from an MD?
Oh, for sure. As Freud put it, a doctor has. Freud thought that medical education was the worst possible education for a therapist because it trained people to think in terms of diseases and cures, and also lacked education in what he thought were essential areas: history, literature, the arts, and so on. Now, I'm not going to say that PhD programs do that, but I am going to say that an MD program is going to be much more likely to train people to look at diseases and cures. And obviously, MDs, in most states are the only professions that can prescribe medicine.
Famously or infamously, homosexuality was included in the DSM until 1973 when it was removed. Is that significant? Does that tell us something about the DSM?
Well, it tells us a lot. First of all, it tells the way that happened was by vote. So here we have diseases that are voted in and out of existence. The same thing happened this year with Asperger's, although the vote wasn't a referendum as it was with homosexuality. So it tells us that we're dealing more with legislation than with science. Mm. It also tells us why the DSM is the way it is today, because after the homosexuality debacle in the early 70s, psychiatry got into a lot of trouble because it was so obvious what was going on wasn't science. And both the insurance companies and the government started to withdraw support from psychiatry. And in order to rescue itself, psychiatrists turned to a even more medicalized approach to diagnosis. The DSM that we have today was really invented in 1980, and it is a collection of disease labels with the criteria by which they are known that looks very scientific in the sense that people can agree on these symptoms, 2 days of this and 14 weeks of that, but still doesn't solve the problem of whether or not. I mean, you could describe homosexuality in a way that you and I could easily agree on how to find it, but it still doesn't answer the question of whether or not it's a disease.
Hmm. What about and I know that hoarding, or I'm not exactly sure what the language is, but hoarding has been included in the new DSM.
Hoarding disorder is carved out of obsessive compulsive disorder, And, you know, the process by which they decide that it has enough of its own symptomatology to mm-hmm. qualify. The interesting thing to me about hoarding disorder is that among the things that you can hoard that qualify you for the disorder is not money. It's a very interesting question because, of course, we're living in a time of rampant, some would say obscene inequality of income. And yet the disorder, the criteria are written in such a way as to exclude money. So people who hoard billions of dollars to the obvious detriment of other people mm-hmm. aren't considered mentally ill. Whereas people who hoard newspapers, which is its own kind of problem, but certainly doesn't have ramifications like money, are. It's a great example of how ideology seeps into the construction of a new disorder.
Or class.
Is what you're saying as well.
And Asperger's has had an interesting sort of trip within the DSM, would you say?
Yes. Asperger's is really a great example of something that's mostly overlooked but is crucial to understanding the DSM. A disease label is a key to resources. And when Asperger's was inserted into the DSM in 1994, it immediately became a great way to obtain resources for children who otherwise did not have a diagnostic label. It was immensely successful. In fact, I would say it was probably a victim of its own success because so many people qualified for the diagnosis that, first of all, it diluted the available services. And secondly, it made psychiatry, at least the DSM in that respect, look bad because this was an example used by critics to say, look how we're medicalizing everyday life. My own perspective on it is that it is a problem that daily life is being medicalized. But on the other hand, you can think of Asperger's as a successful diagnosis because otherwise we don't have a way to obtain resources for children like that. And nobody knows what's going to happen now that it's been removed from the DSM. It was a move.
Whether it will lose the kind of funding that it
yes.
had?
Yes. Yeah, well, clearly it will. If you don't qualify for the diagnosis, you aren't going to get the services. And interestingly, the APA wasn't prepared to say what the effects were going to be of this change, that either at a statistical level, how many people wouldn't qualify, or what the policies should be for children who will suddenly lose their diagnoses. And they really weren't prepared for the people who say, wait a minute, this is now my identity. You've given me this identity. Now you're going to take it away?
Another angle that you look at or another part of the DSM is that it is used for research. And people say, yes, I want to study, you know, manic depression or some of these other conditions that are included in the DSM. Why does that trouble you?
Well, let me talk for a second about why it works. It works because that means that a researcher in 1985 who researches bipolar disorder and one who in 2013, we can say at least that they're more or less researching the same set of symptoms. Now, whether they're researching the same phenomenon is a different question entirely, but they are researching the same sort of uniformity there. It troubles me because for the same reason that it troubles Tom Insel from the National Institute of Mental Health, we're researching all this stuff, but we're researching chimeras. We're researching myths. It's like you build this whole world, as I said before, it's like an Alice in Wonderland world where the research apparatus is organized around these mythical constructs.
I'm trying to explain that. I want to understand that better because let's say I'm researching manic depression. I mean, you're saying that manic depression is the sort of phony construct, and so what I'm researching really doesn't have a benefit?
Well,
or?
If all this research is being done in a medical in the field of medicine, then you're off. You're not necessarily researching the thing you want to get at. The thing you want to get at is the nature and causes of suffering. If you're researching a construct that doesn't exist, you could be entirely going in the wrong direction. Here's an example from the 19th century. In the 19th century, there was such a thing as syphilis, but syphilis was only considered to be the genital sores. At the same time, you had all these people with general paresis, a dementia, who were in mental hospitals, thought to have a separate disease entirely. And research on general paresis wasn't research into syphilis. Of course, later on, it turned out that the syphilis spirochete was present in these people who had general paresis. And so all that research that was done and all that treatment that was done on something that didn't exist or didn't have its separate existence. It was a set of symptoms that were in common, but subsequently were proven to be part of syphilis. Mm. And that's the kind of problem that we have only as writ large, because the entire DSM is a set of constructs.
You say that psychiatry needs some humility. Hmm. That's one of your offerings.
Yeah, so? I don't know if I say that it needs humility. I think that that's actually what Alan Francis thinks. He's a leading critic of the DSM from the other side. He's a psychiatrist who believes that psychiatry has sort of become arrogant. I think that psychiatry needs limits. And humility implies that the limits are going to come from within. I don't have a whole lot of faith in that. I think psychiatry needs to be limited from outside. I also think that's one of the things the National Institute of Mental Health is trying to do, is to, at least to the extent that the authority of psychiatry hinges on the DSM, to say, wait a minute, you guys, you can't go very far with that stuff. And I think that that's really important, because what we have is a private guild, the American Psychiatric Association, in charge of this enormous public trust, determines where all that money goes. And that kind of relying on a private organization, which is interested in the financial well-being of its members, relying on that organization to limit itself is probably not such a good idea.
I'm looking at something in Time magazine, and this is about the National Institute of Mental Health recently launched the Research Domain Criteria, a system of classifying conditions that aims to include genes and anatomical hallmarks in its illness categorization as a possible supplement to the DSM.
Yeah, they don't know how they're going to do this yet. They're in the earliest stages of this. They're looking at rat brains, you know. But and they're looking at things like the startle response as a way to understand the neurocircuitry of fear. But so whether they're going to come up with a supplement or what they're going to come up with, nobody knows. But what we do know is that they're interested in returning to the level of the symptom and looking at the neurocircuitry of symptoms before they even begin to say what diseases may be causing these symptoms.
And that's Gary Greenberg, our guest today on Radio Times, author of a new book called The Book of Woe, and it's subtitled The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry, one of a number of critics of the DSM and its new edition, the DSM-5. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me see what Katie from Westchester has to say. And Katie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question for Gary. I heard him say something earlier that surprised me and wanted him to expand on it. There was something about the fact that right now we think of mental disorders as a product of chemical imbalances, and that there's research to show that that's actually not true. So that definitely surprised me, and I wanted to hear him talk a little bit more about that.
Katie, thanks. Yeah, go ahead.
So back in the late 80s and early 90s with the advent of Prozac, this myth took hold that that what these drugs were doing was treating chemical imbalances. It's a nice idea because we know what the drugs do. They increase the metabolism of serotonin, the availability of serotonin in the synapse. And reasoning backwards, you would say, well, the problem is that there was a chemical imbalance in the first place. But subsequent research shown that this is not the case, that you can't show a consistently imbalanced serotonin system. I mean, it sounds good, but in fact, there are downstream effects that might be much more important in terms of depression. So there's a disconnect right now between the public and the professional. To each other, psychiatrists will talk openly about the fact that there is no single chemical imbalance causing depression or any other disorder, at least not one that we know of yet. And that's one of the things Tom Insel is saying at the National Institute of Mental Health. Look, let's stop looking at this. Let's look at the circuits. Mm. And on the other hand, privately, doctors will tell patients, I'm sure as we speak, every day, they're telling patients that their depression is caused by a chemical imbalance, because it's a very useful myth. But it's a myth.
Katie, thanks for the call. Let me see what Marilyn has to say. And Marilyn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a transgender woman, and this is one of the issues I'm sure your guest understands has been an active discussion in the past several sessions of the DSM. And I'd like to make two points very quickly. First, despite the respect that the DSM people seem to try to treat toward it, we see in practice a lot of jumping to conclusions by therapists because they confuse sexuality and gender. And quite frankly, I realized recently that in the papers I've read, the scholarly work I've read, they talk about gender all the time, but they don't even bother to define it, which, as an engineering professor, makes me a little queasy as to the quality of the conclusions one draws from that. The second is, on the other hand, certainly I have a condition that does not make me sick, but it does require lifelong medical treatment. It requires surgery that almost no insurance will pay for, even with a diagnosis, and it requires lifelong hormone treatment. So let me just applaud your guest in his assertion that not everything that happens is a disorder, but some conditions do need medical treatment that's got to be paid for somehow.
Sure. Well, Marilyn, yeah, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Gary, your thoughts?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think Marilyn's point is the right one. And what we have to understand is that a disease, as I said earlier, really the best way to define disease, since it's very hard to define, is as a form of suffering that we as a society decide to devote resources to relieving. Now, the best way to get that those resources is to say that your disease is an illness, that your problem is an illness. In the case of gender identity disorder, gender dysphoria, whatever they're calling it these days, that's why the disease label exists. Now, what happens with a group of people like transgender people is that they take that label and they use it to their advantage, and God bless them for doing it. It's really a reflection of how confused we are about how to allocate resources. I personally don't have any problem with allocating healthcare resources to people who aren't sick, in the sense that they have a disease. But this is the regime we're under. We have to do that.
Marilyn, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Something said earlier about the practice of psychotherapy, and the DSM is not about practice. It's not about treatment. It's about diagnosis and symptoms, to make sure.
It's explicitly not a treatment manual. Really, the DSM is only designed to provide this vocabulary. That's the story that they tell anyway. It's not about treatment. It's not supposed to be about research or anything else specific like that. It's simply like the dictionary.
They don't like you very much at the APA. You include a letter that they wrote back to you in your request to do some interviews for this book.
Actually, I was only trying to clarify. I'd done all of my interviews. I was trying to clarify a very minor technical point, and they used that as the occasion to tell me that they weren't going to participate further with me in the book, which was a colossal blunder on their part. They should have continued to try to spin and exert pressure and make my life hard. But what they did was they freed me from having to listen to their talking points. It also indicates the kind of blindness of the organization that they would withdraw peremptorily from that process.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Marilyn, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And if you're just joining us, Gary Greenberg is our guest, the author of The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, People's Light and Theater presents Noises Off, July 10 through August 4. A comedy, Noises Off is a revelation of what can happen on the other side of the curtain. Lacey lingerie and plates of sardines appear both in the air and underfoot while a dysfunctional company of actors prepare for the opening performance of the play within a play, Nothing On. Tickets available at peopleslight.org or 610-644-3500.
The fans of the jam band Phish and the rap duo Insane Clown Posse both get a lot of hate. Nathan Rabin spent time with them to find out why, and he wound up a convert.
This was originally meant to be kind of an anthropological book. Who are these people? To becoming kind of a story of fandom from the inside out.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Tune in for Nathan Rabin's adventures with Phish and the ICP in the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, the defense rests in the Bradley Manning court-martial. The Army private is accused of giving thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks. We'll bring you up to date on that. Plus, Stephen King's Under the Dome TV show is shaking up summer TV. It's all next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the DSM, and that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's published and has been updated by the American Psychiatric Association since, I think, 1952, for about 60 years now. And our guest, Gary Greenberg, is a critic of the DSM. We're talking about his criticisms, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Gary, you talked about suffering and that many, as a psychotherapist yourself, you deal with people suffering. So if not medications and if not the DSM, how does one deal with suffering?
Well, let me be clear about this. There's a place for medication. It just doesn't necessarily have anything to do with diagnosis. Good psychiatrists aren't treating disorders. They're treating symptoms. And that's not a bad thing, right? But I'm sorry. The rest of your question, I got distracted by that.
That's okay. If what you're talking about is suffering and the sort of existential conditions of life, things happen, people die, you know, we get sick. I mean, all sorts of things can happen to us. As a psychotherapist, then, what is the most humane approach to people who are suffering?
Well, listening. Providing support, and most important, I think, is an opportunity to be in a place where you can be sort of relentlessly honest. It will look, you know, when psychotherapy has run its course, when this profession gives way to something else, and people look back on it, they'll wonder what it was about our society that made it necessary for people to go off into private rooms in order to do that. But at the moment, this is what we have, and I think that's how therapy works. You create a healing relationship in which people have an opportunity to get to know themselves and understand how they are in relationship to other people.
You also say that in looking at the DSM and looking, I guess, broadly speaking, at suffering, there are things like poverty. I mean, that there are social issues that can have a big impact on someone's psychological or personal life.
Yes, and we've really, as we've been developing this common language of the DSM, we've impoverished our language for understanding those matters. And I certainly don't have a solution to it, but I think it's important at least to point out that we aren't even looking at it anymore, to look at the connection, for instance, between income inequality and rates of mental illness in this country, to look at questions like hoarding disorder. And the financial side of it, we're just losing it. You know, somebody asked me last night at the event I did, you know, what was my solution? And I said my solution is to not do things that make things worse. And I think that the tendency in the DSM to atomize and individualize and medicalize our suffering it makes things worse.
Let me see what looks like Richard from Wilmington, Delaware has to say. And Richard, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Yes. Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a marriage and family therapist from Wilmington and actually a former student of Dan Gottlieb at Hahnemann.
There you go.
My issue as a marriage and family therapist is that very often, especially couples, will come in expecting and sometimes demanding to use their health insurance. And I explained to them why I'm no longer taking health insurance for couples work, because the presentation of a diagnosis for one member of a couple inherently turns it upside down and makes it imbalanced. And it ultimately sabotages the process, which generally has to be one which is fair and balanced. And, you know, they'll get mad at me and they'll go off and find another therapist. I said, well, you can find another therapist. That therapist is going to be committing fraud because he's going to put a label on you for which you do not meet the diagnostic criteria. And I say to them, how could I be your therapist if I'm going to commit fraud? And when you think of the cost to our nation in terms of health care premiums because health insurance companies are paying out monies for services that they should not be paying for. Relationship problems are relationship problems. And when you put a label on one member of a couple, what I found very often is that the person without the label will say, you know what, you've got the problem and I don't.
Well, Richard, yeah, let me take your point and give Gary Greenberg a chance to respond
to
that.
Well, first of all, I just want to commend Richard for being honest. It seems so simple, and yet it is complicated, and he's taken it in the pocketbook, I guarantee you that. But the other thing I wanted to say is just sort of a technical point, which is that it is useful in the couple setting to have this insurance business, because what you do, at least what I do, is I say, okay, which one of you has the mental illness when they tell me they want to pay with the insurance? And that immediately helps the therapist understand what's going on in the marriage. But like Richard, I really strongly discourage this for exactly that reason.
But therapy is expensive.
Yeah, well, therapy is expensive, but it doesn't have to be that expensive. In other words, maybe I don't really need to make $140 an hour to help people with their marriages. I'd like to, of course, but pay me a dignified wage and I'll help you out. You know, I talk with people in terms of car payments. What's your car payment? Well, let's start with that. Because most people, you know, they're spending $50 or $60 on Friday night to go out for dinner.
Right?
Commonly. Or $100 to go to see a movie and get a babysitter, which might be good for their marriage. But, you know, I think it's the case that people can afford more than nothing, and that we therapists have to pay for our honesty. That's what our culture does. It requires us to buy our way out of bad faith. And, you know, that's a hit that some of us are willing to take.
But what I hear you saying is that you don't use the DSM diagnosis to label a patient, but you use it to sort of understand perhaps what the dynamic is between couple.
Right. It's all grist for the mill. It just happens to be a really nice opportunity. Like the third thing that they say, you know, so can our insurance pay for this? Yes. Which one of you has the mental illness? You learn an awful lot about it.
Well, that's very interesting. Richard, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me get, it looks like Joan from Deptford to join us. Joan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, this is Joan. I like to say interesting conversation.
Thanks.
I'm an educational consultant in Southern New Jersey, and we're all waiting for like the fallout from the new diagnostic manual. You know, we get a lot of students that come into districts, and they're classified by their psychiatrist, by their neurologist, autism spectrum, or Asperger's. And all these kids that have been classified Asperger's, you know, poof, they're not going to be classified anymore. And this is going to be a huge deal in the educational world. I'd just like to hear the speaker's comments on that.
Joan, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Gary.
Yeah, well, I have no idea what's going to happen, and that's okay. But, you know, that nobody has any idea what's going to happen. And I guess we're going to find out. This is another – the whole DSM is a public health experiment. We will see what happens as a result of it. The real shame of it is that nobody was prepared for this. It's as if they were going to turn a blind eye to it. There were a couple of states, New York and Illinois, which tried to pass legislation saying that if you were diagnosed under DSM-4 with Asperger's, you could have that diagnosis no matter what the APA decided to do from here on out. I don't know what became of those initiatives. I sort of lost track of them. I think the one in Illinois passed. I don't know what became of the one in New York.
But it's now part of the spectrum, right, as opposed to a standalone diagnosis?
Yes, and it's not explicitly part of the spectrum, and the diagnostic criteria have been tightened. So it's very likely that fewer people will qualify for the diagnosis, which is good in some ways and bad in other ways.
How about ADHD?
How about it? One of my favorites.
Well, go ahead.
Because I'm so distractible.
Many people are, I've found, but yes.
Yes, and so have the drug companies. What's its fate in DSM-5?
Right.
It will be easier to get that diagnosis as a grown-up. That will be the biggest effect of it. The necessity for it to come on in childhood is no longer as significant. But generally, that the ADHD industry will churn on as it has for many years, diagnosing more and more children who don't fit into the increasingly structured classrooms that are increasingly tuned to these standardized tests. I mean, it's a vicious circle that's obvious, and the stimulant drugs help. Stimulant drugs increase concentration and therefore calm children, especially boys, who may not belong in that environment, calm them down.
And something like 20% of boys have been diagnosed with ADHD.
Yeah, let's be careful with that statistic. That was a single question on a 150-question survey, which asked, has any health professional in the last year told you that your child has ADHD? So that was a really overblown news story that just got out of control. But it indicates how suspicious we're getting of psychiatry and of these, especially with our children, which we should be, because the drugging of children in our society right now is really a problem.
Do you think it'd be fair to say with something like ADHD, which is there's the overdiagnosis and probably an underdiagnosis as well, that there probably are kids who truly do have ADHD, but they don't have the diagnosis?
Yeah, and
I don't know if there's any way to know that.
Well, of course there isn't, but those are the kids who don't have resources available to them. I mean, assuming there is such a thing, assuming any of these psychiatric disorders exists in the way that cancer or diabetes do, I think what you just said is true of most of them, that they are over-treated and over-diagnosed in one sector and under-treated and diagnosed in another.
You write about a Joseph Biederman, which is a very interesting story, a Harvard, I guess, researcher.
It was a Harvard psychiatrist who presented with a population of children who weren't responding to the treatments for ADHD, decided that they had bipolar, and created a kind of flimsy argument for saying that, even though they didn't meet the criteria, and convinced his colleagues that the solution to this problem was to prescribe antipsychotic drugs to these children because they had bipolar disorder, and that was one of the treatments. The antipsychotic drugs came to be called mood stabilizers, same drug, different name, and they work because they calm people down. I mean, they're major tranquilizers. You bet they're going to calm you down. And so you have a whole cohort now of children who've been on these drugs since they were very young, whose brain development has undoubtedly been affected, who are obese or diabetic because of the drugs, that's a known side effect, and who've been labeled as lifelong bipolar disorder, none of which is necessarily true.
Well, in fact, Senator Charles Grassley, did an investigation into this whole case.
Yes.
What did he come up with?
He caught Biederman red-handed, because it turned out Biederman was in the employ of Johnson & Johnson, who make Risperidol, which is one of the major one of the major antipsychotic drugs that was being used. Of course, you can't prove cause and effect in these things, but it certainly has the wrong smell to it.
Let me see what Jackie from Westchester has to say. Jackie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks. I just want to say I really respect everything that you've presented today. I was wondering two quick things. Considering I think that we need a way to organize at least what we do know in order to make any kind of progress, what should we replace the DSM with? And the second thing, I am currently a psychology graduate student, and I'm wondering, considering if the DSM is invalid, how should I pursue my research career from here on?
Jackie, well, thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead. And hopefully this is something you're discussing at your graduate school, Jackie. But go ahead, Gary.
Yeah, I don't have an answer to either of those questions. I mean, what are we going to replace the DSM with? There is nothing to replace it with. That's why it continues to chug along the way that it does, and especially with research. So your choices are to research, to go into a fringe area like phenomenology. There's a phenomenology program at Duquesne that tries to look at mental disorders without labels, or to do research with this kind of cynical notion that we're not really looking at anything real, to live with one foot in each world. It's a very uncomfortable situation for people who are in Jackie's position, and I sympathize, because when you have the head of the NIMH saying that nothing in the DSM is valid, then you wonder, what am I doing here? And I don't have an answer to that.
Jackie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You write about melancholia, and you write here, melancholia not only failed to gain inclusion, it was not given much consideration as a kind of, I guess, standalone condition.
Yeah, they wanted to carve melancholia out of depression, the idea being that there's this very specific form of depression, is very easy to identify, relatively easy to identify, that appears to have a pretty good biochemical signature that responds differentially to certain treatments, and also has a lab test that can verify it. It's a very neat...
Which is unusual, right?
It's unprecedented. It would be the only one in the DSM, and that was the reason that it wasn't included.
Why?
Well, because there's the head of the work group that was investigating mood disorders wrote to the people, the psychiatrists who were proposing this, who were very eminent psychiatrists from around the world. I think you're right, but it would be the only disorder in the DSM that would be like this. And what he didn't say but implied is that would make everything else look bad.
Mm.
So that's how stuck they are with this paradigm that they know doesn't really work. They're so stuck with it that when something comes in that could ameliorate that, they say no because of the bad image that it would project.
What do you want your book to do?
What do I want my book to do? I want my book to educate a kind of intuitive suspicion that not just clinicians, but almost everybody has when they read the latest, you know, article about the newest psychiatric disorder. I want people to understand the history and the reality of the DSM so that they're not just, you know, sort of to educate their cynicism and maybe turn it back into skepticism and to help people educate themselves as to what it means if they go to a therapist and they get diagnosed. And finally, I want it to help people understand that the mental health professions may not belong in medicine.
Well, on that note, Gary Greenberg, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure to be here.
And the book is called The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. Gary Greenberg is an author, clearly a practicing psychotherapist, a contributing writer to Mother Jones, a contributing editor for Harper's. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and stay with us. We'll be right back for Hour 2.